My fascination in Sirukkah is not confined to death row inmates by a long chalk. I have witnessed executions. I witnessed Michael Ross being executed. He had an IQ of 155. He snatched girls off the street. We called him the roadside strangler. A hard-nosed New York journalist made a very good comment about Michael Ross. She said, if I was walking up a dark alleyway at night and I heard footsteps behind me and looked round and saw Michael Ross, she said, I'd be relieved. He looks like the boy next door. That's chilling.
When Michael Bruce Ross was just 10 years old, one of his many chores was strangling the weak and deformed chickens on the family egg farm in Connecticut. As a young boy, he cared little for the birds and was more concerned with pleasing his parents. By the time he was 21, a man later dubbed the roadside strangler had progressed to choking the life out of human victims. The seeds of evil that would claim eight young women were sown in a violent household where Ross's mother, who was later admitted to a psychiatric hospital, dispensed erratic and frenzied punishment on her eldest child. Her violent tendencies and a relationship with Ross's father that always seemed to be beyond repair dominated a farm life that was far from idyllic.
But you can see from Michael Ross's childhood how it set him on the path of being so bad. He had a horrendous childhood. He was the eldest of four children, totally abused and beaten by his mother. He ended up leaving home an extremely angry young man. And in addition to that, he'd also been raped by an uncle as well. So he didn't like the world at all.
For some years, and despite the abuse at home, which Ross later claimed not to remember, he developed a strong work ethic. He was also intelligent, and his impressive high school grades earned him a place at Cornell University, where he presented as an approachable, although sometimes awkward young man, who had little trouble establishing relationships.
So when he went out into the big wide world, at 22, he's tried to sort of form relationships with girls, and he didn't have the human skills or technique or the empathy to have any sort of meaningful sort of human relationship with other girls.
The explicit charm and good character was paper thin. It was only a matter of time before his sexually charged fantasies played out for real.
They don't become a serial killer overnight. I mean, there's a long incubation period. You know, they start off with petty offences, stalking, looking through windows, touching somebody in a telephone box, getting a kick out of it, a rape, think I won't do it again, then think, oh, I got away with that, I'll do it again, they get hooked on it. Then sometimes it gets to a point where they kill because they have to. The woman's screaming, putting up a fight.
He found that as soon as a girl dumped him, pissed him off, got rid of him, that's when he took his anger out on a victim. Didn't matter who the victim was, it just had to be another girl. And he, in fact, raped and murdered eight girls over a five-year period. But it was always after something happened in his personal life and he wanted to take this anger out on someone else. He saw them as quite impersonal people. He never saw them as victims. He said, if you'd have asked me to go on an identity parade immediately after the murder, I couldn't even pick out the face of the victim I've just killed. He said, but I just needed to take it out on someone.
Once you cross that threshold into murder and you don't get caught, I can get all too powerful. And then the events get closer and closer together until it implodes for them. That's basically what it is. But every serial killer is different. What makes a serial killer different to you and them, me and them? Some people are good, and some people are extremely evil. Most of us live in the middle ground. If we say a deeply religious missionary man would be at the good end of the scale. God-fearing man. At the other end of the scale, you have the devil. And that's where those people sit. We're in the middle, they're at extremes.
There would soon be no middle ground for Michael Ross, who felt compelled to kill. And his taste for power and control over the young women he came across would lead to the violent murder of eight victims, seven of them sexually assaulted, either before, during, or after they were killed. Although fellow Cornell University student Zung Na Tu was one of the last to be linked to Ross, she'd been the first to die. The 25-year-old faced the killer's evil in May 1981, shortly after the pair had been in the same evening class on campus. Police initially suspected suicide when Tu's body was found in a creek at the bottom of a gorge near the fraternity house where Ross lived. Family and friends were furious with the initial assessment and refused to believe that Tu would take her own life. She was funny, happy, highly intelligent, and had the world at her feet. Even when a subsequent examination revealed injuries not consistent with the theory she had leapt to her death, police found no evidence to link the killer to the crime. It would be years before Tu's shattered family would learn the truth of her death. But it wasn't long before Ross's criminal intent landed him in jail. Shortly after graduating from Cornell, where he'd studied economics, he was convicted of an assault on a teenager that could have been far more serious. Police had no idea Ross had already killed, and that he would kill again when their intervention effectively saved the life of the 16-year-old girl who Ross had dragged into a local woods. A fine and a 2-year probation served as no deterrent, and Ross set about finding more victims, killing 7 more girls in just 3 years. Intimidating them, raping them, comforting them, and then killing them.
He would tell them, look, I'm just gonna rape you, all right? And he would perform the act however he did it. And then afterwards he would say, he'd get them to lie on their stomachs and say, look, I'm just gonna tie you up and I'm gonna walk away and leave you, so just cooperate. So he would tie them up, and then once they were on their stomachs, looking on the ground, he'd get behind them and he would then just garrote them from behind.
In January 1982, Ross killed again. This time, 17-year-old Tammy Williams, who lived just a mile from the Ross family farm, was raped and murdered. Her body wasn't found for more than 2 years, leaving her devastated parents to wonder what happened to their only child. Less than 2 months after Tammy Williams went missing, Paula Pereira's body was found by the roadside in Wallkill, north of New York City. The 16-year-old high school student had been missing for 2 weeks after hitching a ride to a vocational cooking class. It wasn't unusual for Pereira to hitch rides with strangers against the advice of her friends. But this ride with Michael Ross would be her last. In June 1982, Deborah Smith Taylor disappeared after an argument with her husband. Their car had run out of fuel, and rather than stay together as they set out to find a service station, they went in different directions. It was a decision that would cost Smith Taylor her life, as Ross took his fourth victim. Mischievous teenager Robin Stavinsky was the next to die at the killer's hand. A successful track and field athlete at school, the 19-year-old was said to be strong and muscular. She went missing in November 1983. Although family and friends found it hard to believe, Ross had overpowered, raped, and murdered Stavinsky. On Thanksgiving Day 1983, Stavinsky's mother Joan had the heartbreaking task of identifying her daughter at a morgue. The depths of depravity that Ross had trawled in killing his first 5 victims would be surpassed by the murder of April Brunet and Leslie Shelley. As close as sisters, the best friends had been to the movies and were hitchhiking home when Ross offered them a ride. Instead of taking them to their anxious parents, Ross drove them to a deserted road at Preston and began his assault. He forced Shelley into the boot of his car so she couldn't escape, before turning his attention to Brunet. In his confession, Ross claimed Brunet used a small knife as she desperately tried to defend herself, while Shelley shouted words of comfort to her friend. Brunet was brutally raped and then strangled to death before Ross returned to the car for Shelley. Ross later said he had considered Shelley to have been brave, so he decided not to rape her, but instead killing her, choking her to death. That way he could avoid the possibility of Shelley identifying her assailant. It was April 1984, and April Brunet and Leslie Shelley were just 14 years old.
He wasn't haunted by any of his victims other than the youngest one, the 14-year-old one. For some reason, that one, he said, played on his mind, but the rest of them, he had no effect on him whatsoever. So he killed these innocent girls, raped them, garrotted them, and had no impact on his mind at all.
Wendy Baribault would become Michael Ross's final victim. The 17-year-old's body found under a pile of rocks on the side of the road in Griswold, Connecticut, in June 1984. She had left a note to her parents to tell them she was walking to a local shop, but never returned. This time, during their investigation, police received a tip-off that a man had been sitting in a blue Toyota car close to where Baribault had been found. Ross owned a car matching the description, and since his house was in the vicinity of the murders, he was one of the first suspects police visited. The game was up. Some serial killers deny their guilt, leaving the detail of their murders to be unpicked by police and their forensic teams. Others can't wait to tell more, driven by ego and the same power that had compelled them to kill. Michael Ross's immediate admission to several murders was only part of his story. Prompted by criminologist Christopher Barry Dee, he spilled the final chapters with alarming candor, allowing police to uncover the extent of his serial killing.
He sat in front of me and I had two unsolved homicides that I wanted to clear up with him. And I wanted from him information that only the police and nobody else knew. And we'd formed a good relationship, if you like, through correspondence and a previous visit. People say, why, you must be terrified, you must be scared, it must frighten you. But it doesn't, because I am as cold as ice when I'm with them. They can tell me anything. They can shout, they can scream, but they can't touch me. They won't touch me because they only kill the vulnerable people. And if you show any emotion whatsoever when you're interviewing these people, you become weak in their eyes. And it is that control. It's knowing that they are psychopaths, they can lie and cheat and lie and cheat, but I'm already inside their heads and I manipulate them. I have no fear at all. He knew that I was compassionate towards him. In other words, I made sure that he had Coca-Cola and I made sure his cuffs were taken off behind his back and he was unshackled. And we were talking and talking and I could see him manipulating. He was boasting about his murders, how long it took to strangle a girl, that sometimes there were multiple bruises around their necks because they wriggle around on the floor, then he lets it off because he can't come and he needs to build his sexual pressure up again. And I looked at him and I didn't even blink and I said to him, Michael, you're not a big hitter. 6'7", what's that? You're not a Ted Bundy. You're not a Kenneth Bianchi, you're a small fry. Little guy. And he looked stunned. I said, you've only got five. And he suddenly said, no, I've done seven. I said, no, you haven't. He said, I've done seven. And I have to worry about entrapment. You understand me? And he said, I killed Zungnuk 2 and Paula Pereira. I said, no, you didn't. And I said, tell me about Zungnuk 2. He said, well, I threw over a dam into the river, he said, at Cornell University. He said, I didn't kill her. He said that she drowned. And then I asked him about Paula Pereira, and I had all the crime scene photographs, everything, the maps, everything. So I leant across to him and I said, Michael, with Paula, what did you do with the body? He said, I dumped her by a willow tree near a little stream by a pull-off off the road. I said, what was she wearing? He said, and he told me her school uniform. I said, what did you do with the body then, Michael? He said, I treated it like so much trash, like garbage. I'd used her, abused her, and walked away. I've got my confessions. The police, armed with that, and armed with the transcripts and the film tapes of that, went back to interview him. And he was subsequently charged with another two homicides. And I had letters of commendation from the New York State Police and the Crystal Run Police, and letters of thanks from the parents for putting their minds at rest. But that's what happens when you get involved with somebody like Michael Ross.
In July 1987, Michael Ross received six separate death sentences for killing Wendy Baribault, Robin Stavinsky, Leslie Shelley, and April Brunet. In July 1994, following years of legal argument, the death sentences were overturned because a judge had incorrectly excluded a letter from a psychiatric report. 4 years later, Ross gave up his fight against his death sentences. He claimed to have felt guilt and in prison found God and worked as a Braille translator in the hope of redemption. Some saw him as a reformed character, including Susan Powers, who was engaged to the killer but broke up with him 2 years before he was put to death. On May 13, 2005, Michael Ross, a sadistic rapist who had killed his victims to cover his tracks, was administered a lethal injection at Osborne Correctional Institution in Somers, Connecticut, watched by the family of some of those he had murdered. The roadside strangler was dead. In the dry, hot summer of 2005, the desert city of Phoenix, Arizona was facing an unprecedented number of gruesome homicides. Serial shooters Dale Hausner and Samuel Dietman were vying for airtime against the brutal Baseline Killer in the most heinous possible way. Randomly shooting dead people on the street.
I was a public information officer, and at the same time, we had two cases come up, a series of crimes that were distinctly separate, but apparently serial cases. One of them was the serial shooter case, which started out with a number of animals being shot and turned into a number of people being shot and then a number of homicides. And the other one was the Baseline Killer case.
Instigator Dale Hausner was determined to make headlines.
The serial shooters kept track. They would follow the Baseline Killer case as well as their own case and the numbers of people that were murdered.
Thinks he's notorious. He was on the news. It was almost like, well, this serial killer got the press tonight. We better go out and do something so we get the press back on us, you know, the notoriety on us. He was all about himself and being in the limelight, as so many serial killers are.
Yeah, and that's not unusual. Again, this is all about damage and control and fear and anarchy, and that's what these two did on a daily or weekly basis. That's what you have when you have serial murder. You have people that want to cause as much damage, as much fear in a community as they can, and that's exactly what they did.
Detective Clark Schwarzkopf was the lead investigator in the serial shooter case.
It's not unusual for thrill killers to cause as much havoc and damage as they want to, as they can. When you're a serial murderer and you target humans, you do it because you want to inflict pain on the human. If you want to inflict pain on humans, what's the one way that you can do it without shooting a human is shooting their animal. People are very attracted to animals, and you can cause a lot of carnage and you can cause a lot of heartache to the owner of that animal when you gun it down.
When Phoenix police realized they were dealing with two sets of serial killers, the urgency to identify and capture the killers plaguing the city was palpable.
It was a shock to the police department because it was something that the police department had to face, not only with trying to solve this, but manpower to get enough people to cover certain areas so that they could try to catch this person, deal with the public to satisfy their needs and to calm the public down. It was quite a task for them, something that I don't think they've ever been faced with before.
And you're talking about 14 months of chaos and havoc and fear in a public. So the longer the series went on, obviously the more pressure it became. Our story gained more interest in the summer of 2006 based on them stepping up their activity when the Baseline Killer fell off. So ours became more and more pressure towards the end of the case, the last 2 months, than it was in the first 12 months.
It takes a very strong toll on you, especially when you're working 100 to 120 hours a week, trying to balance all those things. but what you have to keep doing is just you have to keep pushing forward. The goal is to get a resolution, to make an arrest and stop the crimes. So you just have to keep looking towards that goal and not letting things that come up detract from that.
Dale Sean Hausner was born in Nebraska in February 1973. The youngest of five boys, Hausner grew up with a tough disciplinarian father. A school dropout, malicious behavior came early to Dale Hausner.
He was a bad seed from the very beginning. He is a psychopath. At age 8, he set his lawn on fire. When he was 17, and I'll go through the progression of how bad he really was. He was a master thief from about age 10. At 17, he went to purchase a vehicle and tried to negotiate a lower price on the vehicle. And then the owner said no. And Dale came back later and arsoned the vehicle, blew it up basically, and started it on fire. At about age 18, he went to work at a Walgreens and began to embezzle products from the store to fund his whatever it was he was doing. He was completely antisocial. Dale was, like I said, born bad.
Samuel John Dietman was born in October 1975 and raised in Minnesota. He married his high school girlfriend, fathering a child with her, but they later divorced. Dietman developed a criminal record that spanned forgery, disorderly behavior, drunken driving, and shoplifting. By the time Dietman was arrested in 2006, he'd already notched up 37 encounters with the police across two states. Tracy Wittenberger's brother Ron Horton knew Dietman.
He lived with my brother for a short time, and he wasn't a bad guy at that point. I think he was just down on his luck and ended up getting in with the wrong people. He didn't have a job. He didn't have anything. So this person was taking care of him, and I think that kind of led him into this path. He was doing what he was told for a place to stay and food to eat and drugs and beer, and not beer, but liquor. He was just kind of following Dale.
Sam became kind of a sociopath, where he was actually put in different situations because of his social upbringing and who he associated with. That's how he became dangerous. Dale, on the other hand, was just a bad, bad person from the very get-go.
The torment of drive-by shootings had continued for over 12 months. But with the shooters leaving few clues and no eyewitnesses, police had little to go on. So they continued to ask the public for help.
Well, you want to solve it as quickly as possible because you don't want any more people hurt. But the problem was we just didn't have any information. We had no witnesses, no one that could identify anybody. One shot fired, very little information on vehicles. So we're basically grasping in the dark. These guys are operating as ghosts late at night. I mean, your typical stalking, predatory type of violence, and we were struggling to try to get any information, any intel we could, any tip that we could, to give us some kind of direction to go.
The more information the public has, even if there's no solution yet, the more they know, the more they're aware that the police department is willing to share with them, the better it is in terms of the public remaining peaceful and vigilant and calling it, because there's a great dependency to get tips from the public.
There was a key witness that came forward, and we were putting tips out or asking for the public's help all the time and telling people to be vigilant and call in with any suspicious activity. And boy, we got thousands of calls. But we did get one call from a gentleman who said that he thought he knew who was killing these people, and that was Ron Horton.
Horton was perhaps one of the most unlikely people to call police with a tip-off.
My brother, on the outside, was rough, tough biker kind of guy, but he was very generous and kind. I know it was very difficult for him to do what he did, to turn Sam and Dale in, because he considered it snitching, and bikers don't do that. So I know that that was difficult for him, but he felt he knew he was doing the right thing.
I had a ton of respect for Ron, and still do to this day, and his family. And Ron was the type of guy that hung out with some rugged, rough people who wouldn't talk to the police if their life depended on it. But yet Ron, knowing what he knew and knowing people were getting killed, came forward. I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to Ron when that tip came in, and I interviewed Ron about what happened over the phone, and then I met with him later on in the day.
Ron Horton's information was key to leading the police to the identity and whereabouts of the serial shooters.
Ron knew specifics about the case that the public didn't know about, and he learned that from Sammy, particularly using a shotgun, a 410 shotgun. Nobody knew that. So when Ron told us that, we knew we had something good there. Ron's story was he hung out at a bar with a bunch of his friends, played pool all the time, and he was talking to this friend of his named Sam, and one night while they were drinking, Sam just asked him if he knew what it was like to kill anybody. And Ron thought, no, that's just drink talking going on, and kind of pushed it aside. But then Sammy just kept pushing the issue, even started telling him about shooting somebody. So Ron thought, well, there's more to this. I know what's going on in the news. I better tell somebody about it. And he did. He came forward and told the police and told me his story.
Police already knew who Samuel Dietman was. He'd been named as a person of interest for an arson attack on a Walmart store. Following Ron's revelation, Sam immediately became a person of interest in the serial shooter case.
Well, I convinced Ron to obviously try to make contact and stay in contact with Sammy, try to meet for beers and whatever so we can get a tail on him, so we can keep an eye on him. And not only that, to see who he's hanging around with and where he's living. He wasn't worried, and he was willing to take that on if somebody was to threaten him or come after him. He was ready for that. He still felt in his mind that he wanted to do the right thing and end this killing spree.
The investigation team wanted Ron and Sam to meet again quickly. Sam would likely reveal more leads to Ron, enabling police to make an arrest. But getting Sam to meet Ron again wasn't so simple.
The first night we were able to identify Sammy through Ron, he was trying to arrange a meeting with Sammy that night, and so we could get our surveillance going that night. Well, it turned out Sammy did not want to have anything to do with Ron during the night. He seemed preoccupied. They were texting each other back and forth, and Sammy just wouldn't cooperate with Ron that night. But come to find out, that's because they were out hunting a victim, and they found one, the young girl in Mesa, Arizona. And we found out that, and Ron found out that night and was just devastated that he couldn't convince him.
I know he took that last, I believe it was like a 21 or 22-year-old girl. He took that one really hard. He felt that had he done something sooner or pushed Sam to meet with him sooner, that he could have prevented that one. So that one really ate at him.
The following night, Sam accepted Ron's invitation to meet for a beer. The police were ready and waiting.
When the meeting time happened, our vehicle that we knew we were looking for pulled into the parking lot with Sammy in it, being driven by who we later found out to be Dale. And that was the vehicle that we knew they were driving when they were doing these crimes.
The reason we knew, and the reason I knew, was I was sitting in the bar parking lot waiting for Sam to show up, and I saw the vehicle roll in. And at that point in the investigation, we'd had a pretty good description from one of the victims, and I recognized the vehicle immediately, and I knew it was our two guys. We were able to get the license plate of the vehicle, a description of the vehicle, and then we had surveillance units follow Dale after he dropped Sam off at the bar. When we followed Dale Hausner, he went looping around the city and took a route which he should have never taken, which was down Van Buren Street. He was surveilling Van Buren Street. It was a killing street for him in our city. There had already been 6 shootings on that street alone. So when I followed him down that street, I knew that he was surveilling it, and I also knew that we were on the right track with the right person.
We kept a tail on him the whole night, and he led us to where they were living. Sammy, on the other hand, stayed at the bar with Ron. They drank, they moved to another bar, did a little more drinking, and then comes to find out that Ron took him to a casino, and that's where he left him.
The police had to tread a fine line between gathering evidence and intervening to prevent a kill while retaining their cover.
It was the worst night of my life as a police detective or officer. This is where it got really, really, really scary. We knew that they shot from their car, and we knew that there was 2 of them, or at least I knew that. Sam was seen taking something from the trunk of the vehicle and placing it inside the vehicle, which was a bag. And of course, we first thing we thought of, okay, that's the gun they're going to be using. So with multiple people, multiple surveillance, we watched them troll the streets of Southeast Phoenix, Chandler, Gilbert, in circles, slowing down, looking for pedestrians, watching people on bicycles, doing counter surveillance of people looking to see if anybody was following them. And for 2.5 hours, they trolled those streets looking for someone to shoot. And we could tell based on their actions alone, with a plane overhead watching them, 10 surveillance units continually rolling around them, we knew that they were out there actually looking for victims. They actually rolled up on 2 kids on a bicycle, slowed down, but we had units right on top of them going both ways and a guy right on their bumper, and they failed to shoot. Sam later told me that they were going to shoot, but the coast wasn't clear.
After they started cruising the streets looking for a victim, they were pretty confident they found one that they were intending on assaulting, but we shooed those people out of the area, that person out of the area. And then it started raining, so they just drove home back to the apartment.
By the time Dale and Sam returned home, undercover police had wiretapped their apartment.
We were able to listen to them, and they were chatting quite a bit. They were bragging. They were comparing themselves to the D.C. sniper that was going on, that had just occurred in Washington, D.C., and they were pretty proud of what they were doing.
For about 7 hours that evening, they would switch channels on their TV to every news station that was covering any information about the serial shooter case. And we were monitoring the same stations that they were watching and flipping to. Then that night, for the very first time, and Sam admitted this, he goes, it was the best night for you guys to tap our conversations, because they went through numerous shootings that they had been involved in, laughing, yucking it up, talking about individuals who'd been shot, individuals who went down, individuals who'd been screaming, individuals that they actually on one of the shootings actually went out and contacted the victim. They talked about that. They made fun of Robin Blaznick, who was the last murder victim.
You look familiar. You know, Blaznick?
I think so. I know a Blaznick.
Making fun of her name, they called her Blaznick, which referred to the shooting of her with a shotgun. So they went through numerous cases and laid them out for us, and that was all we needed.
That wiretap was crazy. You know, before, when we first got the wiretap on, and Dale had a daughter, a little daughter, and this just killed us to listen to, was when they put the daughter to bed, Dale told the daughter to tell Sammy not to kill anybody tonight. And she repeated it.
Say goodnight, Sam.
Good morning.
Good morning. See you in the morning.
Good morning.
Say, don't kill anybody.
Good morning.
That's too early. Good
morning.
Say, don't kill anybody.
You know, to hear a little kid say that in her baby talk was just gotcha.
Over the next few days, the investigation team patiently listened and watched Dale and Sam, accruing little pieces of evidence that would later help to convict the pair.
Sam had emptied a garbage full of trash, thrown it in a trash bin. One of our undercover units had seized it, brought it down to me, and inside it we found some very incriminating evidence. A piece of paper with the victim's name on it, a shotgun shell, of the exact same caliber and cartridge that was used on our last victim. We were able to get newspaper clippings from this garbage on days of the murder. So it was a map, which actually pinpointed locations where they'd actually shot people. It was a treasure trove.
Within 9 days of Ron Horton's telephone call to the Phoenix police, the SWAT team stormed Dale's apartment and arrested him and Sam. The serial shooter scourge of Phoenix was over.
Seems like it was just yesterday when we were so tired and we'd been up when we made the arrest. Most of us been up for like 54 straight hours. We hadn't slept. You know, we were unkept. We were, you know, we were just done. We were at our end's rope. And I look back at that and I go, I wonder somehow how we survived, how we really functioned, how we were able to put it all together in such a very short period of time, a 14-month crime spree of serial shootings within a 9-day period. Dale had told me that he thought it was some kind of drug sting because he was a heavy methamphetamine user. Both he and Sam were. And they used drugs constantly when they went out and shot people. I think that was where Sam got the courage. I think it fueled Dale's passion for the thrill killing.
The investigators were confident they had the serial shooters in custody, but they didn't want to get the hopes up of the families devastated by the killer's crimes. After all, police still had no eyewitnesses to the murders, and getting a conviction would be another major hurdle.
It was a tough case to prove. It was when you don't have witnesses and you have very little evidence, and most of the stuff that you have is tough to try to prove in court. The question was, whether a jury would be able to look at this and figure it out based on just small pieces of evidence, was it enough to convict both of them of 8 murders and 27 other human shootings and then 15 other animal shootings?
Schwarzkopf interviewed both suspects extensively. At first, he thought Sam was the ringleader. That impression soon changed when he interrogated Dale.
Well, I just sat and let Dale talk. I let him explain, you know, his life. He was the one that broached the series. And I just let him talk about it. He was laughing at police, how stupid we were, how you couldn't find somebody, how come we couldn't set up, you know, people on corners to catch these guys. So I let him just continue to hang himself as he continued to tell us and tell me how ridiculously dumb investigators are when we are dealing with this. Why couldn't we catch these guys? And then he proceeded to lay out his guns, what he had, his ammunition, how he knew Sam, where he met Sam, how Sam came into his life. Everything that I would need to just basically come back and say, well, what about this, this, and this? What about the map I found in the garbage? What is this? Oh, I don't know what that is. Well, what about the shotgun shell that's in your garbage? Oh, I don't know what that is. What's this name on this? Why is this victim's name written down? Why do you have obituaries of people that have been murdered? So once he realized that the game was up, then he kind of shut down. But for 5 hours, I sat and let him tell us how stupid we were.
Dale came across as, you're never going to catch me. I'm too good and too great at what I do to catch me, and real arrogant. Sammy, on the other hand, was somebody that seemed like a follower and would do anything for somebody that's trying to lead him to do bad things. And he was more of the pretty passive and apologetic and pretty calm of the two.
Sam Dietman turned state's evidence for us, so he gave me everything in numerous interviews about how they would plan their attacks, what they would do, what they did to finance their operations, how they got their money, how they got their drugs, how they picked their targets, everything.
Sam's confession was a thrilling development for the investigation team. In contrast, news of their star witness, Ron Horton, was grave.
He became ill right after that. So he wasn't alive during the trial at all. Because I remember the detectives coming to the hospital to see him, because at that point they were concerned about the whole case being gone. And he passed away probably, within a few weeks, right?
I think it was pretty close, yeah.
I was there the day, just pretty much the day he died in the hospital. I remember going and seeing him, and I knew he, even though he was in a coma, I went into the room by myself and I grabbed his hand and I said, "Ron, you're great." I told him I loved him and he squeezed my hand.
In March 2009, Dale Hausner was convicted of 80 counts of attempted homicide, drive-by shooting, and cruelty to animals. He received the death penalty. 4 years later, he committed suicide. Samuel Dietman was convicted of 2 homicides and conspiracy to commit homicide, and sentenced to life imprisonment.
You know, I never had the sense that it was joyful. I had the most of the sense was relief. I was relieved for those suffering families and loved ones who needed to begin to be able to work through their grief. I was relieved for the investigators who just poured themselves out endlessly. And it was more of relief.
After Dietman was sentenced, Tracy Wittenberger corresponded with Samuel Dietman while he was in prison.
It did give me some closure. I did ask him how he felt about Ron, knowing that he was the one that turned him in, and he was grateful. He said Ron was a good friend, and he was glad it happened. He wasn't angry at him, and you know, that gave me some peace, too. Not that it mattered what he thought, but it helped me. Detective Daryl Smith has kept in touch with my mother ever since. I mean, it's been, 9, 10 years now? And he still calls her on my brother's death, you know?
It was a tragedy. I mean, horrible. But, yeah, I think sometimes, too, when these horrible things happen, it does bring people closer together.
Like our family.